I'm Jenny Lawrence, a former trustee and a longtime member of the library, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Bob Wilson this evening, author of the new biography of Phineas Taylor Barnum, aka P.T. Barnum. Let's begin by turning off our cell phones. A few words about the New York Society Library and an appeal for your continued support of its ongoing programs. Its founding goes back to 1754, and by the way, the word society in the library's name has no connotation of class. Rather, a group of individuals whose purpose was to create a, quote, public library that would be very useful as well as ornamental to the city. I was intrigued to read in Bob's biography that before Barnum bought Scudder's American Museum's collection of curiosities in 1841, Scudder's Museum shared space with the New York Society Library in City Hall. The museum was intent on entertaining New Yorkers, catering to the grotesque by exhibiting in 1794 a French guillotine complete with a beheaded wax figure of a counter-revolutionary. By contrast, the Society Library in the other wing of City Hall was intent on improving the lives of New Yorkers by building a collection of books for serious readers. Barnum, who proved to be a prolific and entertaining writer, published the first version of his best-selling autobiography at the end of 1854, The Life of P.T. Barnum, written by himself. Curious to see if our members were reading the book, sure enough, I found 8 entries in a charging ledger for 1855, the point being to show how au courant the library has been, whether 1794, 1855, or today. We are still thriving after 265 years. Barnum's revision of his autobiography, Struggles and Triumphs, was a favorite of Mark Twain's, possibly because it provided him with cannon fodder to satirize Barnum. In July 1874, Mark Twain, tongue-in-cheek, wrote a newspaper article that they had teamed up to rent the tail of a great comet currently visible in the night sky for, quote, an extended excursion among the heavenly bodies, end quote. The plan was to fix up a million staterooms in the comet's tail, each room with all the amenities ranging from hot water to a parachute. The cost would be $2 per 50 million miles of travel, and the date of return would be December 14, 1991. Requests for further information were to be addressed to, quote, my partner, but not to me. My dear Clemens, Barnum wrote, I owe you 1,000 thanks for taking me into partnership, and invited Clemens and his family to his Bridgeport home for clambakes and jolly times. And now to the source of these anecdotes. Historian Bob Wilson has been editor of the American Scholar since 2004. Before that, he was editor of Preservation, founding literary editor of Civilization, book editor and book columnist at USA Today, and an assistant editor at the Washington Post Book World. Magazines under his editorship have won 5 National Magazine Awards. His essays, reviews, articles, and fiction have appeared in newspapers including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, and in magazines including The Atlantic, The New Republic, and Smithsonian. He has taught writing at the University of Virginia, George Mason University, American University, and Johns Hopkins. Bob is the author of 2 previous biographies, The Explorer King in 2006 about the writer, geologist, and explorer Clarence King, and in 2013, Matthew Brady, Portraits of a Nation. And now this new biography. What is it about Barnum? The temptation is to compare him to our showman president, but Barnum, who should be understood in the context of his time, was a complex, multidimensional character with insight and humor. He is a hard act to follow, and as you will soon hear, no one has quite measured up to him since. Please join me in welcoming Bob Wilson, bringing you the exuberant humbug of P.T. Barnum and his 19th century America.
Someone asked me for another one of these events, what I needed to be prepared, and I said, a lectern and several gallons of water will probably suffice. I should say that Mark Twain and Barnum had a troubled relationship. They were friends of a sort. Barnum kept trying to get Mark Twain to endorse various projects of his, and Twain, to his great credit, held Barnum off, and it was a real full-court press on Barnum's part. But as Twain was dying, he reread three books that he had loved in his lifetime, and one was Barnum's autobiography. So, thank you, Jenny, for that great introduction. Thank you for having me here. Thank you to Sarah also for setting this up. And thanks to all of you for coming on a night when you could have been home listening to Wolf Blitzer or Ari Melber talk about impeachment. I don't know how you resisted that, but it's been a great pleasure to work on this book. I've been working on it for about 6 years. As Jenny said, I have a day job, so I can't say I was working on it morning, noon, and night. But to spend that much time with one person could be a great challenge. And I have a friend who was in the middle of a biography of Jean Stafford years ago and decided halfway through that she utterly despised Jean Stafford. And that would be a very hard situation to be in. But I was continuously engaged by Barnum. Sometimes I was enraged by Barnum. Sometimes I was disappointed in Barnum. But generally, I just very much enjoyed his company. He is a man of such exuberance, such creative gifts, real imagination, real wit. He had just astounding verbal gifts. He was a wonderful speaker. He was the sort of at early midlife, he decided that he was going to speak out against alcohol. And he was one of the really sought after temperance speakers in America and gave hundreds and hundreds of free speeches about temperance. And then his autobiography is truly, I think, a wonderful book and really an important American book. One of the things I try to talk about in my book is to talk about Barnum as an American character too, and to think about really his strengths and his weaknesses as being, to me, very American strengths and weaknesses. And of course, in his era in the 19th century, this question of what is an American, what does it mean to be an American? My magazine, The American Scholar, is of course named after Emerson's great speech. Well, it has as part of its subject that very question. And I think one of the things as a writer that I appreciated most about Barnum is just what a great character he was, meaning that not only the energy that he had for his life, the joy he had in his living of his life, but you know, if he were a perfect man, he would not be a very interesting subject for a biography. And so his flaws are part of what kept me very happy while working on this book. He grew up in a village in Connecticut called Bethel, which was not a terribly prosperous village, but people were not dead poor either, but they all worked hard. They all had multiple ways of getting a living. And Barnum indeed was filled with that spirit of entrepreneurialism from an early age. He, I think at the age of something like 8, he was making candy to sell to the militia that would drill on the village green. And he found other ways to get pennies and nickels from his grandfather, who would pay him to do chores. And at one point, his grandfather encouraged him to go to the store and turn in all his change and get a silver dollar. And he says in his autobiography that dollar, just no amount of money ever felt better to him than that one silver dollar. Like many people in small town America in those days and in small and big town America today, he was drawn to New York, which was not far away, which was known as York. And I'll just read you a very short passage about his first visit to York. He was known as a boy by his middle name, Taylor. In January 1822, when Taylor was not quite 12, a friend of his family's passed through Bethel on the way to New York to sell a drove of fat cattle. The man mentioned that he was looking for a boy to help with the droving, and Taylor got the job. Thus came about his first chance to go to York and to see the great city. For spending money on the adventure, his mother gave him a dollar. Once the man and boy arrived in the city, Taylor had a week on his own while the farmer was busy disposing of the cattle. Again, Taylor felt that a single dollar in his pocket made him immensely rich. But what followed was the usual lesson that the excitement of a great city does not come cheap. He spent much of his time in a toy store buying various toys and then losing interest in them and selling them back at a loss. Buying other things until over a period of several days, not only was all the money gone, but he had, in his frenzy of acquisition, bartered away his handkerchiefs and a pair of socks. When he returned home with no presents for his siblings and his mother noticed the missing articles of clothing, he was whipped and sent to bed. Still, for Taylor, the painful lesson was mitigated by the mere fact that he had been in York, which made him for a long time quite a lion among the schoolboys. He did a number of jobs around Connecticut, including working in his father's store and in other stores. There's a lovely passage in the autobiography of him in his role as a clerk and taking on airs and being very theatrical in the way he dealt with the customers. Everything was just about was done on the barter system then, so there was a lot of give and take, and he loved that. When he came to New York, at one point he opened a porterhouse. He had some other businesses. He ended up going back and starting a store in Bethel and got into the lottery business. The private lotteries were popular and kind of a family business and something that drew him. At the age of 21, he had become so disenchanted with the role of religion in public life that he started a newspaper called The Herald of Freedom, in which he took issue with that religiosity and with what would turn out to be Barnum-esque zeal. He managed to libel several people in the process, and one of the libels landed him in jail. He had a choice of paying $100, which he could well afford, or spending 60 days in jail, which he saw would have great publicity value. And so he took the latter. He took the latter choice. He managed to have his jail cell decorated. He was able to run his newspaper from the jail. He had so many friends to visit that he couldn't get his work done, and he engineered a huge celebration on the day he was released with, you know, bands, cannon fire, three cheers, gala luncheon with many toasts to him, and it just went on and on. And I say in the book that this, which I mean, and he clearly had engineered this celebration of him on his release from jail, and it was the day he became a showman, basically. He eventually, when he moved back to New York and started a boarding house, and excuse me, and then he came upon an exhibit that was, he had this sense that he thought he could be a showman. He thought he could make a living and do a good job of exhibiting interesting people, interesting objects, and he was searching for things like that to do. And he came upon the story of a 160-year-old black slave woman, a woman who claimed to be 161 years old, a slave woman who also claimed to be the nursemaid of George Washington. So, you know, who could doubt it, right? And he was excited. This woman was being exhibited in Philadelphia. He rushed down there, interviewed her, and ended up buying the rights to exhibit her. This, I won't go into the details of this, but it was, even Barnum realized this was sort of a low, would, looking back, this was sort of a low point in his life as a showman, but it led to other things too. Later he as Jenny said, had a chance to purchase this dusty old museum. It had fallen on hard times since its glorious days of the guillotine exhibit in City Hall. But it had many, as a natural history museum, had many sort of dusty objects and fossils and things like that. Barnum bought it, and although he had no money, he famously, a friend asked him how he bought it, and he famously said, with brass, for I had no gold or silver. And he did indeed, and that's a good story I won't tell right now either. But he managed to almost immediately begin to make money with American Museum. He had it decorated with large flags, and he had a big light put up on the roof that shone up Broadway. It was on Lower Broadway below City Hall Park and kind of across from St. Paul's. He hired a brass band that played out on a balcony over the front of the building. And by design, the band was so bad that it drove people into the museum to get away from them. Anyway, he did that. And then he, at some point, after not too long, he was introduced to a young person from the town of Bridgeport, where Barnum would end up living much of his life. And this was a perfectly symmetrical, attractive little person, a dwarf of 24 inches in height. And Barnum met him, and somehow in their first meeting, Charles Stratton, as his name was a bit shy, but in fact he was a person of real energy and had these, like Barnum, had these wonderful innate gifts as an entertainer. Barnum immediately decided to name him Tom Thumb, to publicize, which is a character from an old English folktale, to publicize the fact that he was 12 years old when indeed he was 5. Because Barnum felt that if people thought he was 5, they would just think he was small, you know, that he wasn't anything unusual. And he always wanted to add an element of the exotic, so he said he was from England, not from a salt box house in Bridgeport, which was somewhat less exotic. And he was, in a very short time, trained him and he became a wonderful hit. Barnum took him to England with the plan of introducing him to the English by first introducing him to Queen Victoria. Now, he had no earthly reason to believe that he would have access to Queen Victoria, but somehow he managed to do that, and she and Tom Thumb and Barnum became celebrated among the English sort of aristocratic classes. And then there was Jenny Lind, the Swedish opera singer, Barnum at some point in his life realized that, you know, he was building a reputation for himself, but it was with acts that were not wholly respectable, and he felt that if he could get, if he could work with Jenny Lind, who was already very famous, probably the most famous opera singer in the world, beloved in Europe, that it would sort of add to his stature. And he felt that it would be worth it to him to lose $50,000 on the chance of bringing Jenny Lind to America and touring with her. In fact, both he and Lind made a fortune. She gave all of her money to charity. Barnum did not. He built a remarkable house for himself and other things. I'm just going to read just a brief thing sort of about, that's just a sort of overview of his life, and here's another sort of introductory one. He is known today primarily for his connection to the circus, but that came only in the last quarter of his life. His principal occupations before that were running the American Museum and being the impresario behind the witty and talented dwarf Tom Thumb, the angelic Swedish soprano Jenny Lind, who created a sensation in America in the early 1850s, and dozens of other acts and traveling shows. Less well known today is that he was also a best-selling author, an inspirational lecturer on temperance and on success in business and in life, a real estate developer, a builder, a banker, a state legislator, and the mayor of the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut, where he lived most of his adult life. He was even a candidate for Congress, losing a bare-knuckle contest to a cousin also named Barnum. In all these endeavors, he was a promoter and self-promoter without peer, a relentless advertiser, and an unfailingly imaginative concoctor of events or exhibits to draw the interest, often the feverish interests, of potential patrons. Barnum's known today largely for something he never said, which is the quote, "A sucker is born every minute." It's very hard to prove definitively that someone did not say or do something, but he wrote hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words and autobiography and letters and other things, and it appears nowhere in print, and no one who knew him ever quoted him as saying it. And more importantly, it just totally misrepresents his relationship with his audience. His audience is both at the American Museum in these shows, these exhibits, and later when he went on the road. And I'll read a brief thing about it. Central to Barnum's philosophy and success was the relationship to his audience that he developed during his decades as a showman. That relationship centered on the single word most associated with Barnum in his lifetime, humbug. As he himself wrote in his 1865 book, The Humbugs of the World, Webster's definition is to deceive, to impose on. Definitions today include the words hoax, fraud, imposter, nonsense, trick. Barnum's book is a survey of such practices, intended, he said, to save the rising generation from being bamboozled by the unscrupulous, whether in religion, business, politics, medicine, or science. Now, you could say this is a bit Trumpian in the sense that he's sort of blaming others for what he is accused of doing. But for Barnum, not all forms of humbug were hurtful. Sometimes humbuggery could be harmless, even joyous. He claimed that for him, the generally accepted definition of humbug focused on this benign variety, which he defined as putting on glittering appearances, novel expedients, by which to suddenly arrest public attention and attract the public eye and ear. In other words, what he did. The crux of the matter was that a person who attracted patrons in this way, but then foolishly fails to give them a full equivalent for their money, would not get a second chance from customers who would properly denounce him as a swindler, a cheat, an imposter. And so this was the deal he made with his audiences, that that they would be in on the joke, basically, that he would bring them into the museum or into an exhibit, and it might be something outrageous like a 161-year-old woman or the Fiji mermaid, which was quite obviously the desiccated corpse of a monkey sewn artfully to a fish. But once they got in, they would see that, good old Barnum, as he was known, had, tricked them again, but then there was all this other entertainment available to him, and that was part of the deal. Enough about Barnum, let me talk about myself. Some lovely things have happened with the book, and one of the things I'm most proud of is I think it's just a beautiful book. I mean, it's a beautiful object. I just love the cover. I can say this, I think, because I can take no credit for it. It has a beautiful inside design, lovely color pictures, and it has something called deckled edges, which I guess all of you as library people know what that is, but that instead of having the end cut straight, they're kind of rough cut. And I told my editor early on that I really wanted deckled edges on my book. I wanted deckled edges on a book before I died. And I'd always wanted deckled edges. And he said, oh, no problem, we can do that, which I completely disbelieved. And I didn't believe it until the first box of books came and there the deckled edges were. But I mentioned this to my wife, who is here, and with whom I have been married for 45 years, and she said, I've never heard the word deckled come out of your mouth, much less know that you've had this lifetime, longing for deckled edges. To which I said, well, every good marriage must have its secrets, and deckled edges were my secret. And then I also had the amazing thing happen where CBS News called up and decided they wanted to do a segment on Barnum and on Barnum the book and on me to some extent in the Barnum Museum. And so I had the opportunity of doing that. And I'll tell you, it was just great for the old Amazon number. It dropped about 25,000 points. You want your Amazon number to be as low as possible, since number one is the best Amazon number. And then the third thing that happened, which was quite remarkable and quite unexpected, was that the New Yorker, in which my name has never appeared and I felt would never would appear, although there was a rumor that they had asked for an extra copy or two of the book, and I thought maybe I'd get a little postage stamp thing in the back somewhere, did four pages on the book. And and not only that, but Elizabeth Colbert, one of their star writers, I mean, the writer of The Sixth Extinction and Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote four pages. One of Martha's and my friends, when she sees me now, she refers to me as four pages, because she's so shocked that they would do this. And so that was wonderful. It was very exciting. But I had to, as an editor and a writer, I couldn't help but notice that she seemed to imply that I had spent 6 years writing about Barnum in the era of Trump and other things going on today and had not, in my mind, ever made a connection between, had not really thought about the fact that Barnum had some relevance to the moment. And indeed, my book is not really about that. That was clearly, though, a choice I made. So that raised a great mystery in my mind, which is, how could this dim-witted fellow, meaning me, who would write a book and not have any idea about its relevance, write a book worth summarizing at four pages? Did I mention four pages? And to do so, I must say, with almost no attribution. But anyway. But still, you know, it is what it is. And but then I realized sort of halfway through the piece that Colbert was really going after me. She really had, she decided she was going to really hone her language and, you know, kind of stick it to me. I was right in the middle of the piece. And the heart of her four-page review was whittled down to three words. And the words were, Wilson admires Barnum. This was considered to be a great insult to me. Not by me, but to me. And I'm making a big deal of this just as a joke, but this question of how much I admired Barnum, or how admiring of Barnum my book was, has become a question in several of the reviews, and you know, I think I knew when I was writing the book that I was presenting a more favorable picture of Barnum than had, but certainly than his general reputation, but also than some others had presented, and I felt as I went through the book, sort of page by page and line by line, that I was always very skeptical of him. His autobiography is so great that there's a real temptation to just quote him all the time because he says everything better than anyone else could. But I did write about him with skepticism. But a lot of the cliches about Barnum turn into things that are more complicated than most people who know even a little bit about Barnum know. And I felt that, you know, really my responsibility was to drill down as far as I could in these things and to let the chips fall where they may, even if they involved admiring him. I mean, I've talked a bit about his good qualities and the things that I admired about him. But he did a lot of things that, I mean, the temperate speaking, he, in spite of his sort of objection to religious and public life, he was a universalist, and he was a man who was motivated by his religious beliefs. He certainly had despicable views about race early in his life. His temperance speaking in part, and also the views of his wife, began to moderate him, and he eventually became an ardent abolitionist. And in fact, when he ran for the Connecticut legislature after the Civil War, he said one reason he ran for it was so that he could vote for the 13th Amendment when it came through, and which he did, like on, I think, almost the first or second day of his being a legislator. The things that are, you know, you can rightly criticize him for, that, you know, the humbugs that went too far. He did not treat his wife well, I don't think. And partly this was one of the things I talk about in the book is that his town was very into practical joking, and he was himself the victim of a remarkable practical joke, which I hope you'll read about. But and there was a kind of rough humor associated with that. I mean, practical joking is has an element of cruelty as much as fun, and a lot of times his sense of humor verged on that. After he and Tom Thumb met the Queen, everybody wrote about how successful it was, and he was invited back. But in her journals, the Queen said she was very troubled about Barnum's relationship to Tom, that she wasn't sure he was treating him right. And I think some of that was probably this rough sense of humor with which he taught him, because Tom loved Barnum, and they had a great friendship throughout their lives. And, you know, his need for wealth and adulation is something that's not admirable. And his treatment of animals is another thing that, although his views became better and better through his life, and indeed, he became a great friend with the man who founded the ASPCA, who at one point asked Barnum to be the Bridgeport director of the local ASPCA. But, you know, I think it's hard to, even if you do as I tried to do throughout the book, which is to, you know, think about Barnum as a man of his time, but then also think about him as a human being. And, you know, if he, if some of his attitudes towards animals were, you know, a factor of the way people thought about these things at the time, that's one thing. But then if there's an element of cruelty there, that's another thing. Anyway, I tried to work through all of this. And so I think one of the real questions, if you read the book, that you might think about is this question of how much we should admire him. I do think if Barnum were in this situation, he was famous for putting something awful out there, finding someone who criticized it, rightfully so, and then he would publicize both viewpoints and say, come to the museum and spend another quarter and decide for yourself. And so I would say, you know, the New Yorker says one thing, the Atlantic says another, buy my book and see for yourself. I'll just read you one more short passage. When Barnum's autobiography came out in the 1850s, he was in his 40s. He was born in 1810, died in 1891. It might seem, you know, brash to write your autobiography at that age, but his father died at an early age, and life expectancies were, of course, much shorter than they are today. And of course, he had no way of knowing that he would live to be 80. And the book was very popular in many ways. Jenny said it was a bestseller. It got over 1,000 reviews, which seems unbelievable until you think that there were 150 newspapers in New York City alone at that time. And many were favorable, most were favorable, but there were certainly people that were deeply offended by the book, and they were deeply offended by the fact that Barnum talked about humbug, and he admitted that he did these things, and he admitted that he made a lot of money from them. And it was almost like people were more offended by the fact that he would talk about it than that he did it. And it really stuck in the craw of a lot of people, including James Gordon Bennett, the editor of the New York Herald, he and Barnum essentially just tortured each other throughout their life. Barnum was always pulling things on him, and Bennett was always decrying him. So there's that. And then soon after the book came out, Barnum, who had made a lot of money with Tom Thumb, a lot of money with Jenny Lind, got overextended in real estate and went bankrupt. And this was generally thought of by people like Bennett to be the fitting last chapter to his autobiography. You know, there was this brash guy who did all these things and made all this money, and in the end, you know, he got what he deserved. Taken together, the reactions to Barnum's autobiography and bankruptcy provided an unusual and unusually intense public evaluation of a person still in his 40s who is not a presidential candidate or a general or an explorer, say. Barnum had become so familiar a public figure by this time in his life that his name was often used in the newspapers and presumably in private conversations as shorthand for a number of qualities: energetic promotion or self-promotion, interest in the odd or the exotic, business sense and the ability to beat out competition, and finally and foremost, the vast realm of humbug. In the United States, the British Isles, and Europe, Barnum embodied an identifiable American type, the go-getter, and was also one of the most renowned examples of the growing fluidity in social class that was a central factor of life on both sides of the Atlantic throughout the 19th century. Barnum's financial success was one thing, but his acceptance by the British upper class in the 1840s and by such prominent Americans as Commodore Vanderbilt and Horace Greeley in the 1850s suggested that a person could move not only from rags to riches, but even from obscurity to respectability. This proposition was what made him such a controversial figure, someone whom James Gordon Bennett and many other editors could routinely denounce to an audience eager to see Barnum put in his place, a man whom Emerson and members of the intelligentsia in the United States and Britain could find both sneer-worthy and also alarming. That the middle classes responded so readily to what Barnum offered, to his hoaxes and publicity stunts, but also to the way he challenged them to see with their own eyes and to rely on their own judgment. And this is, to me, the heart of a lot of what he did. This idea of he brings you in the museum and there are a million objects there. You see things you've never seen before. He has these things and he says, come and decide for yourself. He's telling these middle class people, come develop your critical sense. Come decide what's right, what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, what's true and what's not true. And there's a wonderful thing I quote in the book for somebody who is saying that the Barnum Museum was the kindergarten, the grade school, and the high school for the middle classes. And I think that's true. So that the middle class responded so readily to him was partly what defenders of tradition, the perquisites of class, the intellectual elite, and culture itself, as they saw it, were railing against when they attacked Barnum. Yes, his smugness was irritating, but it was his role as a leader of the mob assaulting the citadels of culture, for example, by undermining serious theater with his moralistic melodramas. His museum had had something called a lecture room, because to call it a theater was to associate it with immorality, because theaters were places where prostitutes plied their trade, where there was a lot of drunkenness. And one of the things Barnum was committed to throughout his life was to create entertainment that families could come to. So he prohibited drink in his museum and that sort of thing. Anyway, for example, by undermining serious theater with his moralistic melodramas, made him a palpable threat. Even those who sneered, however, could get Barnum's place with the average American just about right. John Delaware Lewis, the British son of a Russian merchant, whose sneering came by way of Eton and Cambridge, made a jaunt to the United States and brought back sketches collected in 1851 in a book called Across the Atlantic. He wrote, by going ahead to an extent hitherto unprecedented in his trade, devoid of any absurd delicacy to the means by which the ends are to be accomplished, Barnum has endeared himself to the middle and lower ranks of his countrymen and seems to stand forth proud and preeminent as their model of a speculator and a man. Lewis might not have fully approved, but he recognized Barnum's preeminence. The perennial popularity of the American Museum, which for decades was the premier tourist attraction in New York, the robust sales of his autobiography, the widespread appeal of his nostrums for business, for success in business, and the eagerness of newspapers across the land to print any snatch of news or gossip about him, all prove that, for all his faults, old Barnum was, in our striving democratic country, the object more often of respectful affection than of scorn. So I'll stop now and would be happy to take questions. Yes, ma'am. In short, no. I had sort of talked to a friend of mine at the Daily Beast about writing, you know, a sort of lighthearted piece about how the ways in which the movie didn't quite get everything right. And I came out of the movie with kind of steam coming out of my ears and thought, I don't think I'm up to writing a lighthearted piece about this. But there were so many things about Barnum's life that were so much more interesting than the way it was sort of twisted for, you know, to kind of, you know, to kind of appeal to 21st century Hollywood, you know, values. That, I mean, Martha, who's a more forgiving person than I am, felt that it was an entertaining movie, and perhaps it was, but I did not really like it. Well, the question everybody wants to ask is about Barnum and Trump. And, I mean, I think you could, I mean, I hope from just what I said you would see that there are many superficial ways in which they're similar. You know, the bankruptcy, the real estate deals, the making your name into a brand. I mean, you could say Barnum wrote a book called The Art of Money Getting. So that's, you know, the art of the deal, the art of money getting. And, you know, obviously Barnum had a slippery relationship with the truth. But, I mean, as I've tried to point out, you know, I think that there were, that he's a man of real substance, and that, Barnum had a philosophy that he called profitable philanthropy. If that phrase alone doesn't make you admire him as a writer, then I don't know what will. But his idea was to spend money in ways that would help others but would also help himself. For instance, he developed East Bridgeport, and he sold lots at an incredibly favorable rate and let people pay him back over many years, but they had to build houses up to a certain standard. It was a sort of new urbanism, frankly. I mean, his standards were very much like seaside Florida. But he and his partner would keep every other lot. And so as the community grew in value, his investment grew exponentially. But he actually became a real philanthropist late in life, gave a great deal of money to his church, to Tufts University. I don't know if any of you have a Tufts connection, but if you do, you know that their athletic teams are known as the Jumbos. And they're known as the Jumbos because Barnum sent Jumbo the Elephant was one of his great acts, and Jumbo was killed by a train, and Barnum had him stuffed. But he also had his skeleton extracted, so then he had two exhibits instead of one. The stuffed version went to Tufts, where Barnum had built a science, had given them money to build a science museum, and it was in the main hall of that building. And the building burned in 1975, I was reminded by somebody in another speech. And then it was burned up. He was a real philanthropist and didn't just talk about it. So. Yeah. Yeah, he got a guy in the local paper to write his obituary about a week before he died. I can't quite remember the details.
What was his reaction to it?
I think he liked it. He was so good with, this was one of his, he was so good at sort of making use of all technologies. And you know, one of the amazing technologies of his day was the prevalence of newspapers, and he was he spent a fortune advertising. He advertised in three or four New York papers a day for many, many years. So, and he wrote for the press a lot, and often often wrote things that the press would publish without changing it when, and you know, many things were unsigned. But yeah, so he was, it was as nothing for him to convince this guy to do that, I'm sure, and it was done on favorable terms to him. But I must say, I mean, he was, this idea of Barnum as an American, from the British point of view, I mean, there was a lot of sneering about Barnum's Americanness, but when he died, the Times of London wrote a 10,000 word obituary of him and called him an almost classical figure, and so he did very well in the obits. Did you have another question?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, projecting into, I think you kind of parsing it sort of about the technology, you know, I'm thinking about the technology of today, projecting, where do you think he would be, if you had to project, where do you think he would, if he was alive today, what do you think he would be involved in?
Well, usually this people ask me, how would he feel about Twitter, right?
Yeah,
because I guess of the Trump thing. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't only newspapers, but it was photography, it was railroads, it was telegraph. I mean, he thought of ways of making great use of all of these things. So I think he would be very into using technology in smart ways. Jay. Yeah, well, this idea of him as a go-getter. He had a tiny carriage made for Tom Thumb. It was pulled by little Shetland ponies, and on the side of the carriage, he had painted, you know, a kind of fake aristocratic shield, but the words on it were, "Go ahead." And there's a wonderful article about that an English journalist spent with Barnum called A Go-Ahead Day with Barnum. And what you see, and it's a part of the book I like a lot, because you see the day through this guy's eyes and Barnum's eyes too. And you see his tremendous energy. You see this kind of helpless acquisitiveness. These guys went to visit Shakespeare's grave, and Barnum had a bunch of cards for Tom Thumb, Shakespeare's grave, which is, and he managed to, like, stick one of the cards into the statue of Shakespeare over the tomb, and he offered to buy various things from Shakespeare's house, so there was that acquisitiveness, there was that, but his energy felt very American to people, I think. And I think his freshness, his joy. I think the things on the debit side are, you know, the slipperiness with the truth in advertising, the belief that you could sort of make anything happen with advertising, the over concern with making money. There are probably other qualities I'm forgetting. But
shamelessness.
Yeah, there was a sort of shamelessness, I suppose. But I think it was tempered by his wit, his humor. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to ask what you know about what inspired him to become the guest people in his life, a parent who was a model for him.
Good question, yeah. His maternal grandfather, for whom he was named, and about whom, and Barnum said that he spent most of the first six years of his life in his grandfather's arms, which, as a new grandfather myself, I found very touching. And he was a great character. He ran lotteries. He's the one who pulled this multi-year bad joke on Barnum. But he was a great inspiration early on for, I think, for Barnum's, you know, sort of entrepreneurial sense. He gave Barnum, Barnum was in New York, and his grandfather wanted to come home, and he gave him a piece of land to build a store on and attracted him back. Later in life, I mean, he was, as I said earlier, I think he was inspired by, in the temperance movement, there were a lot of, there were a lot of preachers involved in the temperance movement, and I think a lot of those people helped make him become an abolitionist, although he said that his wife was so great and was so vigorous an abolitionist that even the universalists were too mild-mannered for her. So he was inspired by her, but he was really inspired by his religion. I think his religion. I mean, I think one of the things really remarkable about him. You think of somebody. I mean, how many people do we know who are very successful at an early age, make a lot of money, get a lot of fame, and change and decide, I need to be a better person. I need to give up drink. I need to help people to make their lives better. I need to bring joy to people. And so that's part of what, you know, won me over to him, that he didn't just go with it. You know, he kept becoming a better person, I think, as he went through life.
And in the movie, which you didn't like, I sort of like,
Yeah, no, that's true. That's a great point. His museums burned down several times. He built this great monstrosity of a house in outside Bridgeport called Iranistan, and it burned down. He had five or six great fires in his life, and in his autobiography, he makes a big show of, getting up the next morning, sending out a bunch of telegrams. We need more giraffes. We need more this. We need more that. And so there's that admirable quality to him. But on the other side, he was in England, or he was in Germany, getting acts together for a circus he was putting together in the 1870s. And word came that his wife of 45 years had died, Charity, who in the movie, by the way, was not, who in the movie was a rich girl, and she was not a rich girl. And she was the tailor, not Barnum being the tailor. Why would they change these things? But anyway. He kind of went into several days of staying in his hotel room and being in mourning. But he didn't go home. He didn't support his children. And actually, similarly, one of his children died while he was in Europe, and he didn't go home to support his wife and family. And so there's that side of the resilience that's sort of hard to fathom. He also, although it was not known for 100 years, he married a younger woman 3 months after his wife died. On Valentine's Day, and they hid it they hid the fact of that early marriage, of the actual marriage, and had a kind of sham marriage later in New York, about 6 months later. So that was one aspect of the resilience that's not so good. Yes, sir. He did a big centennial show that year. He was already into the circus thing, and they did a show that was very patriotically themed, and I don't recall his being involved with the centennial, but I should say he did get drawn into the Crystal Palace exhibition in what's now Bryant Park, you know, that was a imitation of the great exhibition in London. And it did not do well. And Barnum, they brought Barnum in to try to stir up interest in it and make it go. And he invested some of his money into it, and he did not make it go, and he got out of it. So his enthusiasm for expositions may have been tempered by that. So. Yes, ma'am. Oh, absolutely. Well, there were definitely specimens of preserved animals.
Or
no, they burned up. I mean, everything burned up. And
the mermaid.
The mermaid went on a tour of the South, and some of Audubon's sons-in-law. Started a big brouhaha about it, and he had the mermaid shipped back and put it up on a shelf for a while. And the mermaid actually belonged to a man named Moses Kimball from Boston, who was another, a very Barnum-esque figure. And so it went back to him. Barnum did borrow it from Kimball later and took it through... took it with him when he toured England on a lecture tour. It's been said a lot that there were a number of these sorts of concoctions, and there's one in Harvard that Harvard has that people have said is the Fiji mermaid. But Arthur Saxon, who's a great Barnum man and trust on these matters, says that that's not true, but there are numbers of them around still. Oh yes. Oh yeah, very much so. I don't think it's ever been out of print. I think there was an estimate I saw somewhere that it had sold something like 1 million copies over the years, and it sold 60,000 in the first year, which I would be happy to sell a tenth of that many my first year. So anyway, thank you very much. Oh, one last question. Is that?
Yeah, one thing. Is it true that in his museum that he has signed this way to the egress?
Yeah, that's true.
That's the way of emptying the museum.
Yeah, making people come back and pay another quarter. Yeah, no, that's a true story. And he also had one of his things about drunkenness is it's very common for people to, either jump off a train and go have a snort somewhere, or to go to a play and go out and have a couple of snorts. And he had a rule that if you went out to have a drink, you had to pay to come back in. So. Bailey was a real circus man, and Bailey was the genius behind the Barnum and Bailey Circus. By the time Barnum got involved with the circus, he was really just a name that was lent to the circus, and he would go out as part of the draw of the circus. People would come to see Barnum as much as the circus, but Bailey was a competitor of Barnum's, and he was so much better at it than Barnum was. And for instance, he would do circus dates in the same city that Barnum was in at the same time in order to draw business off from Barnum. So finally Barnum said, look, we need to join this guy because we can't compete with him. He's too much. And he was the person who had the real genius for organization, that he was very much involved in the skill of essentially packing up a city on a train and moving it and unpacking it in a day. And he was very much in the opposite of Barnum. He was a reclusive guy. He had to drop out for a while because of his depression. And he had this interest in details. And so he was really, I think, very much the. But it's true. Very little is known about his life. I have a sort of sketch of his life, but there's not much more known about him. There's no biography of Bailey. Thank you so much.